each meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from a little cave on a tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened and a vision was revealed. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing in the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us, to some degree, it has always been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let us now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, and author of A Mother's Plea for the Winds Have Changed. Together, we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Winds of Change. Father Coy's here. Father Tom Coy's here. That means it's Wednesday. So glad you tune in with us. And once again, we tried to take you on a journey of thoughtful brain wrinkling, as we are accustomed to doing here, through the past, through the present, praying for the future. I think that's one of the stands of people of faith, you know, or if you are a person of faith, you can't just live in the moment, even though St. Francis of Assisi would like to say some things like that. And there is a part of our spirituality that says live in the moment. And but as you believe in God, you're constantly connected to godly things. And we know that God lives forever. He is not just a God of today. He's a God of yesterday. And he will be a God of tomorrow. Like, remember the little debate that Jesus got into over the resurrection? And he says, a God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God is a God of the living, not the dead, referring to the fact that these people of old times are still alive in one way or another. And a Catholic heart, a Catholic mind, a Catholic mentality is always aware of that. It's always aware that the actions of God and the godly people of the past need to be in our minds and our hearts today. And so we worry that they hopefully won't be snuffed out in the future. That sense of hope that we always will have as believers, even martyrs had hope. Isn't that a strange combination? People who are led to their martyrdom are led so with a sense of hope. Hope goes not only for this world, but even to the beyond. And one of my constant thoughts that I have to bring to prayer, and I share with folks here and there at times, is the idea that I hope we can bring about a greater sense of God-fearing Christian values and principles into our society, into our nation, without martyrdom. I'd rather there not be martyrs. But as soon as I say that, I'm thinking that's going against the whole stream of history. It always seems that there will be, and if we could only figure out how to advance the great, shall we say, cause of Christianity through the world without needing martyrs. I think the need for martyrs springs from, obviously, the presence and the reality of evil people bent on destroying Christianity, as well as a combination of apathy for those Christians who just can't move themselves or have a hard time repenting, have a hard time looking back and seeing mistakes and claiming mistakes and repenting from them and moving on. There's a kind of an apathy that comes I guess it comes to all of us. Isn't that true, my friends? Doesn't it come to all of us? But obviously more deeply at different times of our life. And there may be a few great saintly folks that are exempt, shall we say, in one way, but it's a very small percentage. And we need to thank God for those. One of the lessons of philosophy that I recall from my days in the seminary was the difference between dividing human species into four categories versus two categories. The four category type of dividing human beings goes all the way back to Aristotle, and much of Catholic theology picked up on, especially through the writings of one Thomas Aquinas. And I use this, I find this so practical today, versus kind of dividing human species into two categories of people, exemplified primarily by Immanuel Kant, by all people, if you remember that name from your philosophy days. But Aristotle said, you can divide folks, especially when he's talking about their moral character, shall we say. But it fits other aspects of life, too. But there are the two extremes called the saintly and the vicious. And in between, there's two categories called the, I think he called them continent and incontinent. And those words kind of make you laugh today because it reminds you of perhaps other things that have to do with the bathroom than political philosophy or what have you. But hear me out on this and see if it fits your view of reality, or does the conscient view fit your view of reality? Because I'm going to put a plug in for the Aristotelian view of reality. He says when you look at people, you can almost always bet that there's going to be a small percentage that are really saintly. And those are the ones who, he says, they do the good and they love doing the good. They pursue something good. They do what is right. They avoid what is wrong. And they do it easily and it makes them happy. It's a key characteristic of a very virtuous person. On the other end of the extreme, of course, are this vicious people who never do the good. They do evil, and they enjoy doing evil. And you could just sort of picture different examples in different history, or even maybe people in your own life, as it were. There are some folks that seem to enjoy doing evil. Now, in between then, where he puts the majority of us human beings is those who know what's right, but we have to struggle to do what's right. We fight off temptations, and but we by and large try to do what's right. We fail sometimes, and we succeed sometimes. But there is a inner battle. There's an inner struggle, and below that are the people who know what's right. We know what's wrong. And they struggle, but they often fail. And so they lean toward the vicious side. So you got four categories of people when it comes to their moral character. Once again, just to recap, it's the saintly who know the good and they pursue it and it makes them happy. They do it easily and makes them joyful, makes them happy. Below that are those who know the good, and they struggle with it, though. There's temptations, and you have to overcome those temptations. But by and large, they do it. Oh, excuse me. I didn't push the cough button there. I'm sorry about that. And then there's those below it who struggle with, they know the good and they know the bad, but they usually side with, they struggle with temptations and they usually give in to temptations. And then at the bottom are the ones who know good and evil, but they choose to do the evil, and they enjoy it, they like it. So that's a category. Okay, that's I want you to think about that and say, is that how you consider people and the human race? Is that how we organize our thoughts and when we're trying to, especially leading a country, leading a people? If you're a leader of an organization, even if it's a small one, you know there's going to be that in parish life when we sit around and talk about staff consideration, when we have staff meetings and what have you. We often use the 20-80 breakdown where 20% of the people are the volunteers that do 80% of the work. 20% of the people give 80% of the money. It's just kind of a sad state of reality, but that's that kind of thinking is falling for the classical Aristotelian way of thinking about human nature, as it were, okay? Then Immanuel Kant, though, he comes along in the modern era, and I think this is, unfortunately, a much more popular way of looking at people. And that is, he says, there's only two. He says that the first kind and the fourth kind that Aristotle talk about don't exist. They can't exist. He says that these saintly people who know the good and do it easily and it makes them happy are wrong. They don't exist. They're a phantasm. They're a ghost. As well as truly evil people that know good and know bad, but they choose the evil and they enjoy doing it. So Immanuel Kant says, comes along and as I say, I think this is a more modern way we do think about human nature, that everyone is in that middle, those two middle categories. We all struggle, we do good and we do bad. Doing good never really makes us into the saintly people where we start to enjoy doing good. Or doing bad, even when we do bad, we're always struggling against it, and it doesn't really make a person evil. Someone who does a lot of evil, a mass murderer, for instance, take that crazy monster who shot the 9 people down at the church this past week or already last week. He knew the good and he knows the bad and he was struggling, and he really, really, you really can't call him an evil person because he just fell victim to his temptations and but kind of deep down he was a good person. At some point, I think that kind of thinking it tugs at our hearts because we want to believe that he was someone just like you and me that was fighting against his temptations. We don't want to call a person evil. It just goes against our modern psyche. But doesn't it seem that Aristotle has a good point that there can be, and we should not be afraid to admit that there are these kind of evil people as well as saintly people. Doesn't it seem logical? Even in your own life, it doesn't mean you're virtuous about everything in life. It doesn't mean you're good at everything or you make no mistakes. But there are some things when you focus on a different kind of aspect of life, either sports or let's take the example of a sports or even cooking, let us say. There are some people who play sports and they have to overcome and they have to practice to get good. But there are some that get so good, they do the right thing. They swing the bat the right way. They kick the ball the right way, et cetera. In such a way that it's the virtuous act and they do it very easily. And it is, obviously it makes them happy. You can be a sports person and not be a perfect superstar, and the game can make you happy, of course, but the ease with which you do it is part of our moral framework. And in the sports world, it seems to make so much sense. Yes, there are some of these people that are saints, as it were. We call them heroes, superheroes, you know, or all-stars, I guess you can call it. Or even with cooking, I'm going to use the example of cooking. I'm not a very good cook. I'll have to confess that right away. But I enjoy eating, I'll tell you that as well. But I appreciate a good cook. For me, when I have to do it, it's a slaving over a recipe. I have to check. I get nervous when I have to measure something out. But a good cook, a saintly cook, is one who does all these things, knows them very easily, and probably enjoys it even more than I do. There's almost a joy in the cooking process. For me, the cooking process is a necessary evil to get to the real joy, which is the eating. But in that sense, the saintly cook would be a good example of a saintly moral person, because the moral person sees doing what's right, doing what's good, not for something else, but there's a joy in knowing you did what was right for the sake of doing what's right. So anyway, well, that's kind of a long introductory monologue, my friends, I'm hoping to set you up for, we're going to take a break, but I said I wanted to make a little review of the Civil War reenactment that we had at the St. James Parish not long ago. The talk that the Northern Bishop, Bishop Purcell, gave, the more I think about it and the more I look at it, the more I want more people not just to hear it, but I want to study it, because it rises to the level of a tremendously important meditation on our national identity, to the level of the Gettysburg Address. I'm gonna go so far as to say that the sermon that I shared at the Civil War reenactment is vital to understand. That sermon is to take the Gettysburg Address to a higher level, to understand it. It could be a footnote to the Gettysburg Address, and even an elevating of it. We need to come back to that.
That you just wrinkled my brain, man.
Well, that is our job here at Winds of Change. We are in the brain winkling business. God bless you, Nick. We're going to take a break right now. I'm Father Tom Coyes. I'm sitting in for Father Anthony Bush. You're listening to listener-supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Winds of Change broadcasts from the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy at the historic St. Stanislaus Kostka Church, located two blocks north off Division on Noble at the Division Street exit off the Kennedy. Since 1867, St. Stanislaus Kostka Church has been serving the faithful of Chicagoland since 1867. With your help, St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, can continue its mission to bring Christ to His people. Please donate now by going to sanctuaryofthedivinemercy.org. That's sanctuaryofthedivinemercy.org. And click on the donations link to make a secure donation with a major credit card or debit card. With your help, St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, will continue its restoration and will continue to thrive for the body of Christ.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
Hey, my name's Louis, and I'm the official taster for the Taste of St. Stan's. And I took time out to tell you what's going on because I didn't want to talk with my mouth full, because my mom told me it'd be impolite. Go figure. At the Taste of St. Stan's Sunday, August 2nd from noon to 5, you can taste Hispanic, Polish, Asian, combination, and Chicago experience plates. Could be pizza, could be sausage, in that Chicago experience plate. Tasting's not the only thing you can do. There are kids' games, contests, and karaoke, even if you carry a tune in a bucket. $6 a plate, and the Chicago Experience plate is only $3. Come on down, bring a friend, Sunday, August 2nd, from noon to 5 p.m. on St. Stan's Church grounds, Division and Noble. That's 2 blocks north on Noble, just off Division, just off the Kennedy Expressway. Taste of St. Stan's, Sunday, August 2nd, noon to 5.
Welcome back, everyone. That book that sister was just mentioning in the break, The Prodigal, Evangelizing the Prodigal You Love, it reminds me of a project I'm doing at my parish, which I've mentioned before once or twice, and I want to pique anyone's curiosity and perhaps invite you to consider doing something that I did with my family, which is called a family retreat. You know, we all know what family reunions are, where you get together, and those are beautiful and wonderful in and of themselves. But it's taking the idea of a family reunion and pushing it a little bit more, or as it were, maybe taking a family reunion and injecting it with gospel truths or the faith of Jesus Christ. And the beautiful doctrines and teachings of our Catholic faith. It's such a very challenging thing to do because almost all of our families in modern-day America today are so mixed with different religions. And but to do such a thing is to understand a little bit more the mission of the church. That's what us pastors are called to do. And for you to enter into that with your own family, it would be a very interesting thing. So if you're ever interested in doing a family retreat, I had to come up with a new name, actually, for our family retreat because as we were planning it, obviously, the suggestion was if we call it a retreat, some of the ones who need to come the most are not going to want to come because that word retreat is too holy-sounding. And those who don't like church or those who avoid church will avoid coming to anything that sounds like a holy thing, namely a retreat. And so we came up, we called our day a family Sabbath, a family Sabbath. We borrowed from the Hebrew scriptures, a Jewish word for, I guess they Sunday, their Sabbath is Saturday, of course. But it seemed to do the trick and... but anyways, we're going to have to get that book by sister and see what wisdom she has there. Getting back to the topic du jour, the topic of the day, I want to do a quick review of the Civil War reenactment. I also want to touch on the Pope's encyclical of on the environment. There's a number. I got to weigh in and put my two cents in. There's mixed thoughts and feelings I have about it that I got to share. But this, looking at these two Civil War era sermons, maybe are even more applicable today in the wake of all the talk about racism and the shootings down in the South and the raising of the Confederate flag versus then taking it down, using it, et cetera. What does the flag of Virginia, I've heard it said a number of times that calling the what is considered the Confederate flag really isn't the official flag of the Confederacy, but the flag of the Army of Virginia headed by Robert E. Lee. Of course, the Army of Virginia was the bulk, the major part of the Confederate Army. But anyways, putting that issue aside of where it calls it, but what does the Confederacy mean to the United States of America? What can we be proud about it? What should we be suspicious about it? These two sermons that were presented at our Civil War reenactment, I really think were the best of both worlds, the best of both sides, as it were. And let me start with, maybe I could share a little bit of each one, but I'd like to just give you the beginning of the Northern Bishop. Guy's name was Jean-Baptiste Purcell, or John Purcell. He was a Frenchman, very, very Americanized in his time here. He began to know, and he dove into what we consider the American experiment. I remember asking Tony that a few weeks back about the definition of an American experiment. Is he familiar with that term? And Tony's away on vacation, so that's why we don't hear him just yet. Maybe he's tuned in over the internet somewhere. God love you, Tony. But he said he wasn't really familiar with it, and it made me think maybe there's a lot of people that aren't familiar with that term. America is an experiment. For me, that those two words go together pretty well. I see how when you look at the vast span of history, how America was an experiment, and it still is an experiment, and we're at a crossroads because we're wondering again if the experiment is worthy. A way to put meat on that idea is, I think, in today's world, the European Union is a kind of an experiment. When you put your attention to Europe and you see the difficulties, the conflicts, whether it be the financial issues that are involved with the new money, the currency of the euro, whether it's how the more prosperous, productive countries like Germany are going to handle the debt of countries like Greece, whether the border crossing and the visas are going to work such that you can go from one nation to another. It's an incredible experiment. And isn't it reminiscent of what America was trying to do when it was established? In other words, what I'd like people to open up and think about is that the European Union is a modern-day experiment, very much in the way that the United States was an experiment 200 years ago. Will it succeed? Will we succeed? Will Europe succeed? This is a major question that we need to ask ourselves. And what will destroy it? What will make it succeed? That's what we have to ask ourselves. And that's why I think these sermons that I pulled from history, from the Civil War era, are so significant. As I said before the break, I want to put this talk on par with the Gettysburg Address. So many people say that Lincoln said in such a short amount of time, 2 minutes, or a little more than 2 minutes, he said he packed so much meaning into it. What this sermon by Bishop Purcell that I shared is to put the Gettysburg Address under a microscope, as it were, and allow for more time. And of course, a 2-minute speech is a great thing, especially when you have a big audience and you want to hit a few major points. But indeed, going deeper into it is also a value. It requires greater attention, greater investigation, as it were. So, but some of you who are listening, you may have been there at St. James a couple weeks ago, and you might have heard this. And one thing that I needed to explain at the beginning was that what you are about to hear, and it was a whole 35-minute sermon. First of all, it was a shortened version. The real one would have taken over an hour, hour and a half, perhaps. So this is an extremely edited version, but still it's long enough by our standards, and it still carries with it the basic meaning. But it's a combination of the Catholic bishop from Cincinnati, Bishop Purcell, combined with, and if the truth be known, the majority of the words were from a Protestant minister from Massachusetts. Sadly enough, when I first found the Southern bishop's sermon, Bishop Varol, it was all intact, and it was a major speech that kind of went viral, as it were, and I was able to find it, read it, edited a bit, of course. Father Robert Miller of the Chicago Diocese here did a beautiful job delivering it. And yet it stung in the sense of, here's a Catholic bishop defending slavery in to something I don't agree with. And my first thought was, look at this. Here's a good and holy man, a man who undoubtedly loves his people and is not stupid in any way, shape, or form, very wise and learned, but getting something wrong. We talk about being on the wrong side of history, and it's kind of clear that Bishop Varol was on the wrong side of history, and yet... I want to say he nailed something in the sense that he called, he spoke for the South in a way that perhaps other people who are speaking for the South maybe weren't able to do, because he was Catholic and such a minority in the South. His sermon, I think, takes on a certain amount of more validity, because there were a lot of Catholics in the South that were saying that the fight, the Civil War, the fight over the Confederacy, the fight to defend the rights to own slaves was not really our fight, because there's so few Catholics in the South to begin with, and those few Catholics didn't have any slaves. So the amount of slave holding Southern Catholics is minuscule. But the fact that this bishop, who was not Protestant, obviously, and not a slave owner, comes out and declares, well, what's at the heart of the matter is the issue of slavery. He cuts right to the chase, because many times people would say it's not about slavery, it is only about states' rights. But it's the elephant in the room, my friends. I can't help but thinking the elephant in the room is the what right are you talking about when we talk about the the state rights. Oh, there he snuck in over my shoulder there. I think that is the elephant in the room. You know, it's funny how he sneaks right under the door, too, sometimes.
Oh, no!
It's unfortunate, but, you know, we all have elephants in our rooms, and sometimes they live in our brains. But the elephant in the room, when you talk about the Confederacy and its states' rights, the elephant is, what's right are you talking about? It wasn't the right to grow potatoes instead of cotton. It wasn't the right to make their own currency, which was another controversy. It wasn't a right to have same-sex marriage. It wasn't a right to abortion. All these other kinds of rights that we fight about, at that time it was about the right to have slaves. But Bishop Varol from the South comes out pretty blatantly and says, well, let's cut to the chase, and we know that the heart of the matter is slavery. And instead of kind of apologizing for it, he goes into a long dissertation of a defense of it. But we can see how he's now considered on the wrong side of history. After reading his sermon, I was pushed to say, well, okay, where's a northern bishop who's going to defend the abolition of slavery. And the truth be told, it was very difficult to find a sermon by a Catholic prelate who tackled the issue. There's extreme amount of fear on the part of the Catholic prelates to tackle the issue because they were under the gun, as it were, because they needed to stay outside of politics because so many of the political forces and people were anti-Catholic. And so if it came down on the wrong side of the issue, you would even be more accused of being anti-American, as it were. So that's the part where we're that's where we're at, and so let me give you a little taste before we go to our next break, because here's how Bishop Purcell does start. He did give a marvelous talk when he came back from Europe, and he's it's during the Civil War, and he comes out very strong in defense of Lincoln, although he just touches briefly on slavery. He says, "I returned recently from Europe, and I must tell you that one can retain none but painful impressions of the change which is there manifested in public sentiments with regard to his native or adopted home. America, whilst its people remained united under the aegis of a constitution which, notwithstanding imperfections inherent in all that is human, was justly regarded as the wisest and freest enjoyed by any people, ancient or modern. It was the pride of the world. The eye of the lover of human rights saw but to admire it. The tongue was loosed but to bless her. It is not so now. In the cabinets of kings, in the editorials of journalists, in the conversations of tourists all over, the question of America's approaching dismemberment and final dissolution is everywhere discussed. The experiment of a people's fitness for self-government is said by many to have failed because it was tried on a scale too vast." Now, I want to continue with that because, once again, lay this speech over the lens or over what you know about the Gettysburg Address and see if I'm not right in seeing that this is an elaboration of putting the Gettysburg Address under a microscope and bringing a bit more strong moral principles and Christianity to the forefront of our nation, which is so, so needed today. Let's take another break. I'm Father Tom Coyce, sitting in for Father Anthony Bush. You've been listening to listener-supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
You've heard us say that Winds of Change is listener-supported. That means you help us stay on the air with your dollars and your prayers. And we are asking for that help now. Please take a moment and go to our website, windsofchangeshow.com. That's windsofchangeshow.com. On the upper right-hand side of the page, there is a link, Support Winds of Change Show. Click on that link and donate securely with any major credit card. With your help, Winds of Change will continue to bring you the truth. The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
The tradition continues. I'm Father Thomas Loya inviting you to Prairie Fest.
Friday through Sunday, August 7th through the 9th. Friday night at 7:30. Chicagoland's number one classic rock cover band, Aura. Then Saturday evening, August 8th at 7:30. Prairie Fest celebrates the British invasion with American English.
It was 20 years ago today. Such a ripper told the band to play.
Prairie Fest kicks off Family Day Saturday afternoon at 2 with animal shows for kids, the Innisfree Folk Ensemble, followed by Harvest Moon. Sunday is Polka Day, beginning with Polka Generations at 11 a.m., the Polish Highlanders Dance Troupe, Eddie Carosa Jr., and the Czechoslovak Moravian Society Dancers.
Prairie Fest also has a beer garden, food, children's games, church and prairie tours, $5,000 raffle, and more. Complete details for Prairie Fest are at the events link at ByzantineCatholic.com. ByzantineCatholic.com. Prairie Fest, Friday through Sunday, August 7th through the 9th, at Annunciation Parish, 14610 Wilcook Road, Homer Glen, Illinois.
Welcome back, everyone. We're in the year 2015 now, but I got you back in history again so that we can understand the world as it is today, right? Oh, yes, Sherman. Sherman, would you come
in? Hello there, Peabody here. Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
Well, that would be in the 1860s, because we're talking about, this is 1862, when Bishop Purcell of Cincinnati delivered a powerful speech in defense of, it was a Catholic defending Abraham Lincoln and the United States of America. He saw the United States of America as an experiment. He didn't want it to fail. And that is why I think the idea of the Confederacy just repeating what the American Revolution did is not getting the whole picture. Obviously, that's what Jefferson Davis of the South and all the people who are in favor of breaking off of the United States of America, they saw themselves as just doing what the American colonists did, and that is break off from their mother country. But to see the American Revolution as only breaking off from England, I think, is to miss what the American Revolution fully signified. It was an attempt to try to establish a republic form of government filled with Christian faith. Granted, and I think this is where people like me and people like you who are listening, who are evangelical type Catholics or even evangelical Christians, because so much could be said we are united on. We need to go a little deeper into the theology. But truth be told, the American Revolution was trying to establish a republic that was wedded to Christianity, by and large, those two things. And it was a slam at the rule of kings. I have to bring this little clip in. Nick, you got to remind me one of these days to bring in a clip by an English historian. I was watching the History Channel, which I love to do. I got rid of my TV when I got out to my new parish, and I watch a lot of things on History Channel, and you could watch news on the internet. You can get so much on the internet now. But I was watching a History Channel, and there was a English historian who was speaking about the history of England vis-a-vis its breaking off of the Catholic Church, and he actually criticized the Catholicism with its papal authority because it was a monarchy as opposed to the monarchy of England, which elects its kings. I'm going to bring that clip in one of these days because it just blew my mind. I said, wait a minute. In one swoop, he made mind trick. Nick, do we have the Jedi mind trick somewhere in there? See if you can find that, because this is the Jedi mind trick of the modern world. You got to see if you agree with me, because by saying, number one, that the papacy is a monarchy is a complete contradiction of terms, as well as to say, let's return to the elected kings, the system of elected kings. It's kind of like saying, I prefer, Catholics, you have four-sided triangles, but we here in England prefer two-sided triangles. And, well, obviously, both of those descriptions of a triangle are illogical because a triangle has three sides. What I mean by that is that the papacy, by its nature, because the Pope is celibate and doesn't pass on, the papacy never goes to the child of a pope. Therefore, it is the antithesis of what a monarchy is. And I can't tell you how often I've heard different smart people describe the papacy as a monarchy. And then to go along further and say that we prefer the system of elected kings. Excuse me. The definition of monarchy is that you don't elect the king. The king passes on his rule to his son. That's what. I think you found it there, Nick. I want to get the full effect for our listeners because here's what's going on.
You don't need to see his identification.
We don't need to see his identification.
These aren't the droids you're looking for.
These aren't the droids we're looking for.
He can go about his business.
You can go about your business.
Move along.
Move along. Move along.
I love that little scene. And for those who are Star Trek fans, you know, that's when they were trying to get into...
Star Wars.
Star Wars. Thank you. Very good. Star Wars, they were trying to get into a heavily guarded area to work on their Millennium, some spaceship or what have you.
Millennium Falcon, come on, Father Coors.
Millennium Falcon, that was right at the tip of my tongue. And, of course, they had to get through the guards, and the guards weren't going to let—they didn't have their proper papers, but the Jedi, Obi-Wan Kenobi, was able to change the mind, the way that the— guard was thinking by using his Jedi mind trick, the brain-inducing. That's what my friends, it's so great. Star Wars is a marvelous commentary. We have to be aware of that today because people are playing the Jedi mind trick on you all the time. And if the truth be told, we try to play the Jedi mind trick on other people every day. Be careful when it is something like this in terms of history, when someone ever says the monarchy of the Pope, the papal monarchy. Say, excuse me, don't you know what a monarchy is? Don't you know that a monarchy is based on the passing of the father passing on the authority to his children? And obviously that's not what, it's a long and difficult process for a man to become a pope, and a lot of weeding out goes along the way as a man would rise from priest to bishop to cardinal to pope. Obviously it's not perfect, and some less than saintly, less than wise people have been on the throne, but the average and the quality is, I think, far and away better than what anybody would give it credit for. And do I dare say even a better in comparison to many of the kings and monarchs that have been around. So, and speaking of, maybe I don't want to call our present Pope Francis a bad Pope because I love him dearly and I think he's a beautiful man and he's doing a lot of good for the church. I got to explain because I think he's a little off kilter in the global warming aspect. I don't think his encyclical should be primarily digested as a acceptance of global warming. But I want to come back to that a little bit later. But let me finish with a bit. As time's going by so fast, I want to read just a little bit more of Bishop Purcell's talk because, as I say again, I'm going to repeat myself that I truly think that what his words were. Are on the level of the Gettysburg Address as far as understanding the identity of our country and the difficulties that we face, some of our corporate sins as well as our virtues, what we need. He goes on to say, after he said, comes back from Europe, and many were saying that the demise of the American experiment is it's going to fail. He says, because people over in Europe... They said a nation could not long survive with the contradiction between the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States, the one asserting that all men are born free, sovereign, and independent, and the other that millions may be slaves. That was the contradiction that the Europeans saw in our American experiment. To these European objections, I quote Bishop Purcell a little bit more, which are equally directed against the South and the North, my response is simple. We had been compelled to try experiments in government here in America because those long enforced in the old world had been found wanting, that the systems now in use among Europeans are at least as defective, if not worse, than our own, that however they may disguise the fact with which events from time to time disclose, their public functionaries are not a whit more honest than ours, and their people are even more oppressed and have less chance than ours of rising from their depressed conditions. That these charges are alleged against the unionists of the North, war which was commenced by the South was a bad remedy, and that when by the aid of God we shall have crushed rebellion and restored union and peace, we will revise the Constitution, place this instrument and the Declaration of Independence in harmony with one another, and safeguard the Supreme Court by proper checks, supports, and sanctions, and profit by experience to retain the good and eliminate the evil of the past. Let me stop for a second. And doesn't that, my friends, remind us of a call which we need today? Oh, that our bishops and oh, that our leaders, oh, that our government. And I especially implore our Catholic leaders to call upon a kind of a reform where Bishop Purcell is saying, we get through this conflict and we will, so to speak, change the Supreme Court to amend it to the good and eliminate the evils of the past. Couldn't we see, do you not see the parallel to our day today at how the Supreme Court has judged the killing of the innocent in abortion to be a new fabricated right, as it were. Let me jump to this point, because the Confederate flag, or the flag of Union of Lee's army, if you will, that since it's on the news so much this week, people are saying it doesn't represent racism so much, and I do believe it. Many people from the South have purged themselves of the kind of racism of the past, and they need to be congratulated, all people, North and South, who've had racist ancestors, shall we say. I think we can pat ourselves on the back and say we are much, much, much less racist, and we're more colored blind. That it is completely eliminated, I don't think any sin will ever be completely eliminated. But the real danger, what the Confederate flag represents in my mind, and the reason I don't like it, is because it represents the idea that states will create their own rights, or that the state has, you can build civil law disjointed or divorced, as it were, from natural law. And that's why I think the spirit of the Confederacy that says whenever we dispute about a moral issue, we will divorce ourselves, it has started a political way of addressing problems that is sure to destroy a nation as opposed to saving it. Reform is always different than revolution. That was one of the main lessons that I got from one of the great history teachers I had, Mr. Monteleone. Maybe there's some Quigley students from my time that would remember a great history teacher. And he kept on impressing on us, never forget the distinction between a reform and a revolution. And to reform our country, to reform our society, is not to follow the example of the Confederacy, because the Confederacy says we do not agree with the prohibition of slavery. We think it's perfectly right, natural, just, and all the rest. And so therefore, the Confederate flag says to me, there's a divorce between civil law and natural law, that civil law will trump natural law. And so let us not trouble ourselves too much with trying to determine whether this or that is a moral good or a moral evil. Going back to that introduction that I did at the beginning, where you not only do away with the saintly and the vicious, and so we don't call real bad people evil. We just call them misguided good people. You also do away with the very categories of good and evil in themselves, and there is nothing good in itself. There's nothing evil in itself. If there's nothing good in itself, then everything good is good for another purpose, good for something else. As you could say, slavery was good for the economy. Abortion is good for my economy or my health and well-being. It's not, neither of them are good or evil in and of themselves. So see where I'm driving at here and see the parallels that I think we need to connect the dots, as we often say, and not look at the conflicts of the past. You could look at conflicts of the past and you could say, well, there's always been conflicts, and so therefore there always will be conflicts. So the conflicts of today will come and go. But the genius of the Purcell sermon, especially combined with I think it was a Methodist minister by the name of Frothingham from Massachusetts. He put it so beautifully and says, yes, perhaps a bad and evil will destroy itself under its own weight, because true evil carries with it the seeds of its own destruction, as it were. But in the process, it takes down so many people and even nations. There's a line that, one of my favorite lines from that sermon that I shared was, oftentimes an infected rag from an infected ship has sent a whole town into mourning, if you will. You know, so you come, a ship comes into port and the ship brings in a new disease. And all of a sudden, the whole town has the new disease, and they're all dead in a few minutes, or all sick, or, you know, obviously. That's one of the criticisms of even Europeans coming over here in general. But then he goes on to take that analogy and says, a moral disease, a moral wrong can sneak into a society. It can infect the smallest vein of a finger and destroy the whole society in the process. And that, I think, is the wisdom of the day that we have to see. Finding out and seeing that some of the moral problems are small. Some people say they're small and they're not to worry about. I think the Civil War teaches us not. Some people say they're not even bad. They're good in of themselves. Both of those are poor ways of addressing our problems of today. Well, God bless you for listening. You've been listening to listener-supported The Winds of Change. I'm Father Tom Coyes. You've been listening to WNDZ, The Winds of Change.
What's there to say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deep for truth or sin?